offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and it's my pleasure, like every week, to join you from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. For those of you who have been regular listeners of this show, you know that this is the program where we go through the Bhagavad Gita. We go through it verse by verse in as much detail as possible, and of course we try to study it in the light of Swami's own discourses, Swami's own explanations. And we are in the fifth chapter, and we are, you could say, somewhere near the middle of the fifth chapter, or just past the first quarter of the fifth chapter, and that's where we are. And this particular chapter is supposed to be about sannyasi yoga, but one of the very clear things that is stated and is repeated over and over again is it is not about the lifestyle of sannyasa that Krishna is emphasizing. It is about the mental sannyasa, which is most important. There is no point in changing one's appearance, changing one's dressing, garb and lifestyle if one does not change one's attitude. So Krishna is emphasizing more on that mental attitude of sannyasa and how that is required even for a karma yogi, right? The whole emphasis on the of the Bhagavad Gita, the third and fourth chapter, is on the nature of the karma yogi, and Krishna is inspiring Arjuna to be a karma yogi. But he now speaks that there is no difference between karma yoga and sannyasi yoga, and to be a sannyasi, you still have to be a karma yogi. To be a karma yogi, you need the attitude of a sannyasi. I think that's the point that Krishna is driving home. As we do always, let's begin with a short summary of what we covered last time. We covered three shlokas, shloka number 11, 12 and 13. But before we come to those shlokas itself, this entire portion is where Krishna explains once again how a sadhaka must perceive the actions that one has to perform. Just to backtrack a little bit, he had said that a jnani, a tattvavit, a knower of truth, will not have any taint of karma, even if he performs them. That is understandable because there is no ego, there is no sense of false attachment to the body or the mind or any of that. So it is understandable that a jnani or a tattvavit does not have any taint of actions. But then Krishna goes on to say that even for that karma yogi who performs all actions as an offering to God, such a person also will not have any taint. So that is the first hint that Krishna gives, that how a karma yogi must perform one's actions. All actions must be done with a sense of offering. We discuss this as Ishvara Arpana Buddhi, right? That's the phrase that many of the commentators and many of the great scholars speak of. It's here when we use the word buddhi, it is in the sense of an attitude. So Ishvara Arpana Buddhi means the attitude of offering whatever one does to the Lord, to Ishvara. So this becomes the primary requirement of Karma Yoga. Along with this, there should also be the Prasada Buddhi, which means the attitude of accepting whatever comes as the consequence of one's actions as a prasadam or a blessing of the Lord. And when this attitude of accepting things as prasadam is there, that very attitude will also apply to the present. Because where I am is a consequence of what I did in the past. And so this also is a gift of God. Where I am placed, in what situation I am placed, in which family I am born, into which country I am born, all of this becomes a part of that prasadam that I have received from the Lord. So then I begin to see the present, all the duties that come with the present state or stage of life I am in, as a divine assignment. I am someone's daughter, I am someone's son, I am someone's mother or father, I am leading a team, I am doing this, I am a doctor, I am a lawyer, whatever it is. All of these becomes an assignment that we have received from Swami. So I will carry out whatever is that task to the best of my ability, only to please Swami, because it is an assignment given to me by Him. So from the attitude of Ishvara Arpana Buddhi And prasada buddhi comes the feeling of trusteeship or being an instrument. And from there, this desire of doing whatever one does to please God, sarva karma bhagavat prityartham, as Swami would say. And this is a concept which is not spoken of at length in Bhagavad Gita so far. It will come in a later place, but we can derive that this is one of the important traits of a karma yogi. So in the 11th shloka of this particular chapter that we're going through, Krishna speaks of how a karma yogi acts only using the instruments of the body, the mind, and the intellect, suggesting that just like there is no individuality in any of these instruments or any of the organs of the body, they are put in a certain place, they're given a certain task, and they perform it. There is no feeling of, I am doing this and I need to be rewarded for this, right? So a karma yogi, Krishna says, will look at himself or look at this body, look at the mind, look at the intellect as being different organs which perform the tasks that have been assigned to them. So he or she performs the assigned task by virtue of just being where they are. So in this shloka, in the 11th shloka, Krishna speaks about another very, very effective tool. As long as we all have the mind, we need something to work towards. So a karma yogi in this case, Krishna says, replaces worldly aspirations with the aspiration of purifying oneself. Yoginah karma kurvanti atma shuddhaye. The yogis perform whatever tasks they perform for the purpose of self-purification. And atma shuddhaye, we've spoken about this. This atma is not the self. The self does not need any purification, the higher self. The atma is used in the sense of oneself, right? And it, of course, means the mind primarily. So for the purpose of purifying oneself, the karma yogi takes up the different activities that he or she does. In the 12th verse that we went through last week, Krishna speaks, or rather compares, the yogi or a yukta with someone who is performing karma in a very worldly and a simple way, who is referred to as an ayukta. So it's a comparison between a yukta and an ayukta. So he says, the yukta who has given up the fruits of the actions attains the highest peace, whereas the ayukta gets more and more bound. We also saw the beautiful play of words in this statement of highest peace. Shantim apnoti naishtikim. Where naishtikim might suggest that it is the supreme shanti as well as the shanti that comes, the peace that comes out of atmanishta, or being firmly established in the atman or the self. So a karma yogi's peace in that sense is also limited, right? Definitely a karma yogi experiences more peace than a worldly person, but even the karma yogi's peace can be taken away, whereas the peace that comes out of atmanishta, shanti naishtikim, that shanti can never be taken away. It is unbreakable. This, of course, is also a hint as to what are the milestones a karma yogi will look for in the path. A worldly person will say, am I getting richer 5 years down the line? Am I becoming better at the work I'm doing? Have I grown in the organization? Do I have more responsibilities? These are the ways a worldly person will look at progress. But a karma yogi, a sadhaka, will have to see if he or she is feeling more inner peace, is there more satisfaction, and is that peace becoming more and more undisturbed, right? So these become the milestones when one becomes a karma yogi. This is also a hint as to, this is the 12th verse. The 13th verse, Krishna speaks of how a jnani continues to live in the body even after attaining this understanding. Here the body is compared to a fortress or a palace with 9 gates, Navadvare Pura. The jnani who now knows that he is not the body, he is not the deha, but he is the dehi, the indweller, now he lives in this Navadvare Pura, the city or the palace of 9 gates. like a master. He neither acts, nor does he command others to act. Na eva kurvanna na karyanna. Not acting, not even causing others to act. In this manner, he lives in this Navadvare Pura. And this does not mean that he is inactive. This does not mean that the Karma Yogi gives up action, because Krishna clearly says that he or she mentally renounces all activities. And the mentality of the person is that of a sannyasi. He does not give up actions altogether. And so mentally the person is established in the fact that he or she is not the doer, nor does the person inspire action. The body, the mind and the intellect do what they are supposed to do, as we just discussed. There is no, if you can imagine a person who is a king of a palace and, you know, everything works with clockwork, that one does not even have to command people to act. One, certainly being a king, does not have to take care of things, trivial things oneself. Of course, these are all different analogies and there are always problems with analogies. And today we're going to be discussing that to a certain extent. But these were the verses that we went through, verses 11, 12 and 13. We will go to the next three verses, probably we'll be able to cover them today. So we will listen to verse number 14 of the fifth chapter. We have it rendered beautifully in the voice of Brother Shyam. We'll listen to it. I'll give you a brief meaning after we listen to the shloka. And then we will discuss in detail about what Krishna is saying here.
Na kartrutvan na karmani lokasya srijati prabhuhu na karma phala sanyogam swabhavastu pravartate.
The Lord acquires neither the state of being a creator of the world, nor the actions, nor the connection with the fruits of their actions. But it is the inherent nature that exerts. So this is the 14th verse of the 5th chapter. This shloka and the next few shlokas are going to present some of the fundamental principles of Vedanta, which I personally feel are a little complex and a little complicated, because it is quite different from the way we actually see things and the way we reason. So before I start making an attempt to explain these concepts, let me place a disclaimer that my explanation may not be convincing and may not be adequate. In fact, we did speak briefly about some of these paradoxes even the last week, one of them being na eva kurvanna na karyanna, not acting, not even causing to act, but still being a master, being a vashi, right? This was the description of the jnani who identifies with the self, which means this is the nature of the self. Neither does it act, nor does it inspire or cause another to act. So this is further reiterated in this shloka, but Krishna also mentions who then is the doer. See, we have already said that the individual is not the doer, which means the ahankara is not the doer. We are now saying that the self or the atman is also not the doer. Who then is the doer? We will see an answer to that in this particular shloka, but as I said, it is not very easy to comprehend, but we'll come to that in a short while. Let us first see what Krishna is saying in this particular shloka. He says, Prabhu, the Lord. So this is a continuation of what Krishna was speaking of in the previous shloka. He had said, Aste sukham vashi navadvare pure. The jnani is a happy resident who is in the city of nine gates. And he is a vashi. He is a master. So the analogy, as I said, is like a king who lives in the palace or lives in a fortress. And he is the master, but he doesn't have to do anything. And everything is done by the subjects, and he doesn't even have to raise a finger or raise his voice. Everything is taken care of. So here Krishna, in a sense, continues to speak about such a person and calls him Prabhu or the Lord. But as this is the reference to the self, It is also taken as Krishna referring to the higher self as the Lord, and the higher self is also the Lord who has created this entire universe. And this blurring of lines between the jnani, the self, and the Lord is not coincidental. It is being done out of purpose. We will see that. Anyway, we'll go back to the shloka. Krishna says, Prabhu, the Lord, na kartritvam, neither doership, na karmani, nor actions, srijati, he creates, lokasya, for anyone. Na karmani, simply put, is does not create actions. So, na kartritvam na karmani srijati is neither does the self create actions nor does it create the sense of doership. Now, this can be the self who is the lord of the body, right? We are talking about the dehi, the vashi, who is living in this city of nine gates, which is this physical body. And this statement, na kartritvam na karmani srijati, can be attributed to that self, but if you see, it can also be attributed to the Lord of the universe, who is like the Dehi, if you consider this entire physical creation as his Deha. Right? I hope the comparison is clear. I am not this body, the self, which is the Dehi, is who I really am. In the same manner, the Lord is the Dehi when this entire physical creation is the Deha. So this statement, na kartritvam na karmani srijati, Prabhu, is a direct reference to the self as much as it is to the Lord of the universe. Now the word karmani, grammatically speaking, is that, it is explained as that which is the result of an action. It is not merely actions, but it is that which is a result of actions. Adi Shankara says in his commentary that, let's say you have a pot. Someone must have made that pot, which means that pot is a result of someone's action. Similarly, you have a huge business empire, let's say. Someone has built that empire, so that business empire is a result of somebody's action or a group of individuals' action. So this is the this is slightly different from karma phala, right? When we talk of karma phala, it's a different thing. But this is a more a semantic, grammatical way of putting it. So karmani here means the actions which lead to the concretization of that action, something which is formed in the form of an object. And when used with the words Prabhu, the Lord, and the world, and the word Srijati, right? When Krishna says, uses the word Prabhu, which means the Lord, and also uses the word Srijati. Srijati is to create, right? It's a word which is typically used for the Lord. So this sentence then becomes one with dual meaning. It refers to the Atman. The Atman neither creates doership or kartritva, nor does it create objects and achievements that are born out of that karma. The same thing when referred to the God, you can say the God does not make you and me the doer, nor does he himself do. Right? So this is a parallel narrative which is going on in the shloka and the next few shlokas. And then he goes on to say, na karma phala samyogam. He does not create kartritvam, na karmani, na karma phala samyogam. Nor does he create the union between action and the fruits of actions. In the sense that the Lord does not sit and decide who should get what result for what actions that were performed. We often get into this thinking in this way, isn't it? God is being kind to someone, and to me he is being so unfair. I am working so hard, and so is having things so easy in their life. Krishna says, God does not make you seek something. God does not make you work towards it. And God does not decide if you should get what you worked for or not. That is the importance of this particular statement. He does not create doership. He does not create actions. He does not create karma phala samyogam. What is the action? What is the phala that should be given for what karma? Everything is There is no subjectivity in this. There is no one Lord who is sitting there and deciding who should get what, right? And he says that this is the nature of the self too. The self does not aspire for anything because the self is self-sufficient. Right? That's what we've been telling so far. Because it does not aspire, it also does not choose to work towards it. It is self-sufficient, so there is no aspiration. Since there is no aspiration, there is no commitment towards taking up any particular karma. And though the self is divine, all-powerful, it does not ensure success or failure. Imagine you have the Lord within you. This is one of the things living with Swami, we have understood. We feel that anything that Swami does should have a perfect result. Perfect result according to our thinking. So if Swami builds an institution, it has to be the best institution. If Swami performs a marriage, it should be a match made in heaven. If Swami, you know, somebody who is given a lot of attention for Swami, a student of Swami who has received so much from Swami, he must be the most perfect individual. This is our thinking of what will the result of the all-powerful Lord performing an action. In the same way, we have the Lord within us. We are that Lord. The self, the pure self, is Swami. And this Swami does not ensure that this karma should be successful, this karma should be grand success or something brilliant should come out of it. There is nothing like that. Now let us talk about the most confusing part and the fundamental question that is often asked. As I said, this is not something that is easy to comprehend, at least for me. There might be some people in the audience who are well versed with this, but I'm confessing that it is not very clear. It is not easy to comprehend even for me. Who is deluded? Right? That's the million-dollar question. Who is deluded and who is performing the actions? We said that the Atma or the Self cannot be deluded. He is not the person who is the doer because the karma, the Self does not do any karma. And we've also said the Ahankara, the body-mind complex, is not the doer. That we've already established. Then who is the doer? The Atma doesn't get involved in anything. Neither does it do, nor does it make another do. So even the sense of doership does not arise from the Atma. The Self is also all wisdom, pure, it is incorruptible, and it is perfect. And that is who I really am, that is who you really are. I am not the body, I am not the mind, I am the Self. Then who is deluded here? If you say that the mind is deluded, if you say the Ahankara is deluded, but you have already told me that I am not the mind, I am not the Ahankara, then why should I be worried about somebody else being deluded? Right? Why should I be worried about someone else being in delusion? Because I am not the Ahankara, I am not the mind, I am the Self which can never be deluded. Then who is deluded here? And who is thinking that he or she is the doer? Who is desiring? Who is exulting? Who is crying? If my true nature is beyond delusion, why should I read the Bhagavad Gita? Why should I perform Karma Yoga or any sadhana? Right? This is one of the most fundamental questions which is always asked. Any sincere sadhaka aspirant who has gone through Vedanta at some point will ask this question. You are telling me that I am the Self which is perfect. You are telling me I am not the mind. You are telling me I am not the Ahankara. Then who is deluded? Where is that delusion? Who has to realize? Who has to acquire jnana? One of the methods that is extensively used to explain concepts which are complex like this in Vedanta comes under a category called Upamana Pramana. Explanations that are given using analogies and comparisons and examples. This is in reality a very inadequate tool. I have mentioned this earlier too. We always are working with a lot of analogies. We're working of, you know, the pot and the mud. We have the analogy of the snake in the dark. We have the analogy of the sun hiding behind the clouds. We have the analogy of the mirage. So all of these come under that Upamana Pramana, and all of these are very inadequate in explaining something comprehensively. Just imagine this for the next few minutes. Imagine that there is a person who has never seen a bird in their lifetime. And you have to explain to this person how a bird looks. Right? So remove from your mind all the image of how a bird looks. You've never seen a bird in your life. You've never seen something which has wings and feathers and which looks like a bird, right? Imagine a pigeon in your mind. I have to explain to a person who has never seen a bird in his or her life how a bird looks. What would I say to that person? I will tell, imagine a person. But this person does not have normal hands. The person has hands that are flat. There are no fingers. The forearms are not rounded. The arms are flat and it is covered by cotton-like objects, right? Because they've never seen feathers. So I'm saying covered by cotton-like objects, and I start describing a feather based on something that they've seen. It's like threads, but it is very soft. It is very light. And then I tell them, imagine the nose is not the nose like a normal person. The nose is hard. It is probably made like, material, something like pista shells, and it is pointed, and it is in this texture. It is, there are no teeth. It is like this. It is triangular. And then I tell them, if you remove the skin and the flesh and have only bones in the feet, that is how the bird's feet look, right? That's how the bird's feet look. There is no flesh and muscles in a bird's feet and claws. So what are we actually doing here in this form of explanation? From an image that the person is familiar with, I am trying to build an image of something that the person is not familiar with, the person has not seen. Now, if you can just think of an image that I just gave you, you've never seen a bird, but if you think of the image which I gave you, I doubt if a person who has not seen a bird, from the description that I gave, can ever comprehend how really beautiful that bird looks. When you finally see the bird, you'll say, my God, is this the creature that you described to me? Whatever you said was true, but what I'm seeing is completely different. It looks so beautiful. It looks so graceful, right? And this is the problem with most of the analogies and comparison that we give. Yes, it conveys truthfully and honestly whatever the person is trying to convey, but it never gives the complete picture. In the same way, we give many examples. We give examples of mirages, a person dreaming, the burning embers being covered by ashes, as I said, the snake in the dark. All of these analogies are, in some way or the other, inadequate to explain the concepts of Vedanta, the concept of the self, the concept of where this delusion is, who the doer is, right? They certainly help, but are incomplete. In the same manner, this concept, when I am divine in truth, who is deluded then, is something that is very difficult to explain. But we'll come to that maybe after we go through the next shloka. But who is the doer? As I said, Krishna answers that question in this particular shloka. If the self is not the doer and not even the inspirer of actions, then who propels and who does? Because we are constantly acting. I'm speaking to you. You are listening to me. And probably even as you're listening to me, you're performing some other activities. After I'm done with this, I'm going to go and do something else. So we are constantly in the move. We are constantly acting something or the other. So action is happening. So who is the propeller of these actions and who performs these actions? And Krishna answers, he says, Swabhavah tu pravartate. The Swabhava makes it do all this. It is one's nature which propels all these actions. So it is this nature that must be deluded too, isn't it? Two questions. Who is the doer and who is deluded? Because doership also comes from delusion. So when Krishna says Swabhavah tu pravartate, all actions come from this Swabhava or nature. So delusion also must be in this nature. And we will come to see even Jnana will also have to come into this nature only. So for now, the delusion and the doership is in this Swabhava. But if I am the Atma, the self, then why should I be bothered about this nature which I am not being deluded? That is the million-dollar question. But we'll come to that after we go through the next shloka. So we listen to this next shloka, which is shloka number 15. I'll give you a brief meaning and then we will discuss in detail about what Krishna says.
Nadatte kasya chit papam na chaiva sukritam vibhuhu ajnanenavritam jnanam tena muhyanti jantavaha.
The Lord takes neither the demerit nor even the merit of any. Knowledge is enveloped by ignorance, thereby beings are deluded. The two lines of the shloka are each in a way a continuation of what was said in the previous shloka. In the previous, Krishna said, it is neither the creator of doership nor is it the doer itself, right? Neither does it do nor does it create doership. In law, there is something called abetment of offenses. Right? That's something which is very common. You would have heard this even in political debates and in jurisprudence. Abetments of offenses is also considered as punishable as offenses itself. Right? What is it? Someone has, say, committed a crime, say, of a murder or a theft. The person who has committed the offense is certainly going to be punished. But if there is someone who has willfully in any way helped that person do that crime or in any way instigated that person to perform that crime, even that abettor is equally guilty. But at the same time, there are some people you cannot blame, even though they have in some way aided the crime. So here we are saying that the self cannot be blamed for abetment of offenses. Let us say the criminal has stabbed someone. Now you cannot blame the manufacturer of the knife for the crime that was committed. Or let's say a thief robs someone in the night under the street light. You cannot go and sue the manufacturer of the street lamp. Yes, without these objects, the crime would not have been committed. But there is in no way but these manufacturers or these people whom we are talking about in no way are involved in the nature of the action. So in that sense, you cannot blame them or call them as abettors of that crime. In the same way, the Atma is such a thing. It is like the light. That is why often the comparison is that of the sun. And Swami would often say this. Someone does seva under the sunlight. Someone does crime in broad daylight. Both are using the light from the same sun. But you cannot attribute either merit or demerit to the sun. Right? So in that sense, yes, the presence of that entity is in some way aiding the action. But because the person is not involved in the nature of the action, you cannot call that person as an abettor in the action, abettor in the offense. So in the same manner, without this Atma or self, nothing can be done. But the Atma is neither the doer of action nor the abettor because it has no involvement in the nature of the action that is being performed. The Atma has got nothing to gain or lose. If I were to extend my analogy a little further, the streetlight company has sold the light, the street lamp which has been installed, and it has made its money. Right? Now it has got nothing to gain or lose from what happens under that streetlight. For generations we have performed agriculture using the same sunlight. We have fed thousands of generations. We then say, this is my land, that is your land. Somebody becomes richer, somebody becomes a landowner, and somebody has, using the same land and the same sunlight, somebody experiences a drought and famine and probably, you know, perishes. But the sun has got nothing to do with life or death, profit or loss, because the sun has got nothing to gain from humanity in that sense. It is self-sufficient. The nature of the Atma is also such. When that is the case, it has got no sin or merit. Vibhu, the Lord, na adatte, takes not papam nacha eva sukritam, neither sin nor merit kasyachit of anyone. Right? So that is the nature of the self. Without the Atman, nothing can be performed. If there was no Atman in this body will not be able to speak. But the Atman does not choose what I speak. Right? That choice is left to me, and because there is no involvement of the Atma in the nature of the action that I am doing, you cannot attribute sin or merit to the Atma itself. Then the question still remains, who acts? Who is that criminal then? When I am the Atma that does not do any of the crime, why am I being punished or rewarded for anything that is happening? Of course, we won't complain about being rewarded, but we always have a problem when we are being punished. Only then we ask, why me, isn't it? So why am I being punished if I am the self and the self is not either the criminal or the abettor? Whenever we talk about talk of karma theory, people ask, why should I be punished for a mistake that I did sometime in my past birth? I don't even know what mistake it was, and now you're coming and punishing me for that. I have no memory of that. Why should I receive a punishment? Usually a punishment is supposed to be something that helps you correct your ways. So why should I be given punishment for something which an offense I have no knowledge about, right? This is some problem which everybody has with karma theory. But here we are saying you did not do anything at all, because you are the self that does not do anything, does not make anybody do anything. But still you want to punish me. Now that seems very, very unfair, isn't it? Going back to the shloka, so who is the culprit then? In the previous shloka, Krishna said, swabhava is making a person act. My nature and your nature is making us perform karma and is making us choose the kind of karma. But how is my nature different from who I am? When I am the pure Atma, how is it that my nature is different? When I am the self, how can I have a swabhava which is different? Krishna says, ajnanena avritam jnanam. Ajnana or ignorance covers jnana or knowledge. Yes, knowledge is your true nature, but right now ajnana covers it, and this covered nature of the jnana, this is the nature at this moment, right? Yes, there is jnana under this blanket of ajnana, but right now the entity is ajnana covering jnana. Ajnanena avritam jnanam tena mukhyanti jantavaha. The knowledge that is covered by ajnana is what causes delusion in beings. Here again Krishna gives an analogy of sorts, right? There is jnana, then it is covered by ajnana, something like you have either ashes covering the embers or a blanket put over something. You have a pot which is covered by a cloth. Again, an analogy. There's always a problem with analogy, as we just saw. So he says that this jnana covered by ajnana is what causes the delusion, and so there is karma and hence there is sin and merit. My problem with this is, where am I in all of this? After saying that the self is beyond ignorance, aren't we now saying when ajnana covers it, then it gets diluted? The moment you say that the self is perfect, the moment you say the self cannot be deluded, the moment you say the self is the Lord, the self is Swami, how can there be delusion? How can I be deluded? I say that I am Prem. Let us say that this is my identity. Now say someone puts makeup on me, a wig, a beard, and changes my complexion by applying something and so on and so forth. Another person who is looking at me may be under the illusion that I am not Prem, I am somebody else. How will I be deluded about my own identity? Right? I know who I am, right? You could change my appearance, you could make me grow a long beard, you could probably dress me like a woman, but still I will know who I am, right? Somebody else who's seeing me might get deluded, but how can I be deluded by the makeup that I wear? That is why I said all analogies are limited and we will have to think in a slightly abstract manner to understand this concept. Going back to what Krishna said in this verse, Ajnanena avritam jnanam tena muhyanti. When jnana is covered by ajnana, from that is born delusion. Now from this delusion is born the real problem. One of the results of this delusion is itself this feeling of I, which we refer to as ahankara. This sense of I as an individual self, separate from the rest, that itself is part of this delusion. Now look at this problem. I am asking this whole question of how am I deluded? Who am I? What mistake did I do? Why am I suffering? Why am I going through all of this, etc., etc.? Everything from a subjective point of view. I am the subject who is asking this question, isn't it? But Vedanta tells me that subject, that ego sense, that I am asking this question, that sense, that ahankara itself is an illusion. So in a sense, it is not that the jnani is enlightened and I am deluded. The delusion is, I think I am separate from so-and-so whom I refer to as a jnani. I'll repeat that statement. It is not that the jnani is enlightened and I am deluded. The delusion is, I think I am separate from the jnani. I don't know how much my explanation helped in clarifying this, but as I said right in the beginning, it is not simple to similar to any of the examples that we usually give. Even all put together, it will not convey the same idea, right? But the interesting thing is, this delusion will not leave by merely having this information, right? If I've told you that this ahankara, this feeling that I am the separate entity, is the delusion, okay, you've informed me, so I'm good now. Okay, I'm not the delusion, I'm the self. It doesn't go away like that. There is a certain methodology by which I must get rid of this delusion. And for that, I start with the delusion itself, which means from this idea that I am this individual, I have to start doing certain actions. There are some actions, if in this delusion I do, I will go deeper and deeper inside and will get knotted up. And there are some actions, if I do, I will be able to release myself from this. There are some actions, if I do, saying that I will achieve this, I'm going to chase this, I'm going to build this empire, I'm going to become this, become that, I'm going to become rich, I'm going to become powerful, all of that, I am chasing deeper and deeper into this delusion, into this maya. And that will further change my swabhava. But using the same swabhava, if I take a few simple steps, which are also within this delusion itself, which is what is being spoken of here as karma yoga, then I will be slowly releasing myself from this delusion. This is what Krishna said in one of the verses that we discussed last week, the difference between a yukta and an ayukta. He said a yukta is going to march towards that supreme peace and ayukta is going to get deluded. The yukta and ayukta are both in delusion. Right? That's the important point. Both of them have the ahankara. Both of them have the swabhava, which Krishna is speaking about here. But what you do from that point of I am now saying I am so and so, working in so and so place, doing such and such a thing. From this point, am I going to be an ayukta, further going deeper into this maya, or am I going to be a yukta, a karma yogi, who is going to do actions in such a manner that I'm going to slowly release myself from this delusion. And the more we free ourselves from this delusion, probably the knowledge begins to shine from within itself. Because the jnana is not outside, it is always within. My swabhava or nature is what is making me feel ignorant. Right? So that is the subtle point of this whole thing. Right? When we ask who is deluded, who is doing this, who is doing that, who is the actor, who is the doer, who is inspiring action, the person who is asking this question itself is part of that delusion, itself is part of this mirage. Now this shloka and this portion of 2-3 shlokas, it is technically believed to be part, to be the essential concepts of the Sankhya philosophy. Now this Sankhya philosophy should not be confused with the term Sankhya that is used many times in this shloka, in the shlokas in this chapter. There's the word Sankhya here is used to refer to the path of sannyasa, right? But when we say Sankhya philosophy, it is one of the schools of Vedanta, right? And according to the Sankhya philosophy, there are two realities, right? When we talk about Advaita, we say there is only one reality. But the Sankhya philosophy believes there are two realities, Purusha and Prakriti. The Purusha, of course, creates the Prakriti, but there are two, Purusha and Prakriti. And there is no concept of one merging into the other and one evolving into the other and things like that. So Purusha is pure, and from Purusha, Prakriti has been created, which is nature or creation or whatever you'd like to call that, which is also referred to as Maya or the delusory power or aspect of God. Now when this Purusha and Prakriti interact, Sankhya philosophy says Buddhi and Ahankara, the intellect and the ego, are born. And this further leads to the feelings and emotions of greed, compassion, jealousy, so on and so forth. All of these come from the interaction between Purusha and Prakriti, leading to Ahankara and Buddhi and the rest of the emotions. And when the balance of this combination is tilted towards the original state, using the Buddhi, slowly the ego starts dissolving and the Purusha state is attained. And when I say the Purusha state is attained, it is not the Prakriti becoming Purusha. This ego sense is beginning to see or beginning to relate oneself to the Purusha more than relating to the Prakriti. Something very similar to that is described here. That is why many commentators say that this portion of the Gita is presenting the Sankhya philosophy. And we will see that this is not the only place in the Gita where Sankhya philosophy is spoken of. In other places also there are going to be mentions. So this ego makes us relate to the Swabhava as who we really are. We think of ourselves as this body-mind complex, this personality, or at best this jiva that has traveled many bodies. All of that delusion comes from this ego. So all these are a result of that same Maya. And that Maya cannot be wished off. Today I cannot get up and say, oh Maya, go away, and it will not go away. But with the same ego sense, with the same Ahankara and the Buddhi, we can start working in the direction of freeing ourselves instead of in the direction of getting further bound. And that is the essence of the spiritual path. The next shloka is going to be a continuation of this particular explanation that I just gave. We started a little late, so I think we can go a little further into the next show. I will play the next shloka, the 16th shloka. We'll listen to it. I'll give you a brief meaning, and then we'll conclude with the explanation for that.
Jnanena tu tadajnanam yesham nashitam atmanah tesham aditya vajnanam prakashayati tatparam.
In the case of those whose illusion has been, however, destroyed by the self-knowledge, then for them that knowledge illumines itself like the sun. So that's the 16th verse, and the analogies of different kinds continues. And I repeat again, no comparison is comprehensive and will give us one clear picture. In the previous shloka, Krishna had said, jnana is covered by ajnana, and we spoke of jnana as a quality of the atma and as the Atma is almost unconcerned about the Ajnana and whatever is going around. There was delusion, right? That's the picture that we got. And we had said that how Ajnana is removed using the Buddhi and performing actions using this same Ahankara. Now here we speak of Jnana destroying Ajnana, which is a very assertive action. But there is a slight difference here, and that is something which we have to note. Here we are talking about Jnana and Ajnana in the mind itself. I know and I don't know. I was deluded, I am not deluded now. We are talking about these understandings coming in the same mind, right? Here we are not discussing the nature of the self, which is Jnana. The nature of the Atman is knowledge. But here we are talking about changing the understanding in the mind from Ajnana to Jnana, right? So this is a little different, a slight change in the track from the previous few shlokas. So Krishna says, "Tu, however, jnanena with jnana, tat ajnanam atmanah, that ignorance of the self, yesham nashitam, who destroys it." So that is the first statement of the shloka. It is about that individual who has destroyed the ignorance about the self with the knowledge of the self. And see, that's where the hint comes. We are not talking about the jnana destroying ajnana. We are still talking about the individual who still has this feeling that I am so and so, I am doing this, I am a sadhaka, I am the ahankara is still in action. So we are talking about the individual who has destroyed his ignorance in the mind with knowledge in the mind. Now I am thinking I am this body. I suffer, I enjoy, I do karma, I will face the consequences. This thinking is a result of me not knowing who I really am, because I am confusing myself to be this body-mind complex. This is the ajnanam atmanah, the ignorance with regards to my true self. What is the jnanam then? The right understanding of who I really am. The correct idea of who the self is. Now that knowledge of the self destroys the ignorance about the self. The Atma Jnana destroys Atma Ajnana, if I could put it that way. So our true nature is Jnana, and it is covered with Ajnana, as Krishna said in the previous verse. That true Jnana is the nature of the self, and Ajnana is the nature of Maya, nature of Prakriti, which then creates this Swabhava or this personality. So laboring through Karma Yoga, using self-enquiry, I now start establishing this self-knowledge and getting rid of this false identification that I've created for myself. When I do that, Krishna says what happens in the next line. He says, Tesham, for them, Adityavat, like the sun, Jnanam Prakashyati, knowledge sheds light on Tatparam, that highest. Something similar to what Krishna has been saying. When one attains Antakarna Shuddhi, the self slowly begins to reveal itself. And that is what is referred to as Atma Jnana coming from within, right? And I think it is fair enough to say that this Jnana is the nature of the self eventually showing up in the mind. When the clouds in the sky part, we see the sun. But the sun is not seen with the help of any third party, right? The sun shines, and in the light of the sun, we see the sun. In the same manner, when the ignorance is removed, the self reveals itself as Tat Param, that which is the highest, that which is Brahman. The self reveals itself as Brahman. And when the sun shines, it makes its presence known and also shows everything else clearly as to what they are. There cannot be any darkness, and hence there is a direct perception of everything. As we had seen some time back, this then becomes the difference between knowledge in the mind and the experience of that knowledge. You see that you are the self, and the same self you see in everyone, right? That's another statement which was made a couple of verses back. And all that you have been theorizing and accepting only because you have Shraddha on the words of the Guru, the words of the scriptures, now you actually see it. You see the truth with your own eyes. And this is what we had spoken of as Paroksha Jnana becoming Aparoksha Jnana. That wisdom which was based on the experience of others now comes from my own experience. Right? So in this shloka, that's what Krishna speaks about. The first line he speaks about the jnana, which is an understanding which comes in the mind, right? I think for all of us, probably we could now say that it is beginning to come. Even though we do not experience, I certainly do not experience so much that I am not this body, I am not this mind, though I am saying it over and over again, right? But at least I am convinced that I am not this body and mind because Swami has said so and I trust his words, right? So I am now replacing the ajnana in the mind with jnana in the mind, right? That's what is being spoken of here. One who destroys the ajnana in the mind with jnana. This confusion of the self is being removed with the help of the clarity of the self. But still it is coming from outside. We are reading it from the Bhagavad Gita, we are reading it from the Upanishads, we are listening to it from Swami, we're listening to it from other great saints and sages. But nevertheless, we are countering the delusion in the mind by introducing wisdom, even though it is paroksha, it is somebody else's. Paroksha means the truth which has been seen by somebody else. But because it's a person whom we trust, we take that data. But eventually, we will find that as the delusion dissolves, as the ahankara begins to dissolve, like you're looking at the sky, the cloud is slowly parting, and then you see the sun. The sun never stopped shining. The sun never ever reduced in its effulgence. But when this clouds part, we see the sun in its own light. And as we have said, you know, once the sun shines, there is no doubt. The analogy of the rope being the snake, the analogy of somebody being dark complexioned. In the darkness, you see somebody, you don't know how they look. You don't know whether it's a man or a woman sometimes. Or sometimes you see an object and you think it's a person, but it turns out to be a trash can. All of this delusion or misunderstandings vanish when the sun shines. So that's what Krishna says here. When the sun shines, when the self of the sun shines, it reveals itself to be Tatparam, the ultimate, the Brahman, and it also reveals everything as it is. It clarifies everything, right? So those are the shlokas that I wanted to cover today. Thank you for being with us, being with me, dear listeners. I know that in the course of explaining these, I'm constantly shifting between the Sanskrit terms and terminologies which are often used here and the English words. It could be a problem for some of you to follow. And if I was the listener and you were the speaker, I would have found it difficult to follow, I'm sure. So if at all there is any clarification you need in anything that has been said, feel free to write to me. I would be happy to clarify. I would be happy to share something which, you know, probably which was clear in my mind, but I'm not putting it across properly. Feel free to write to me. You can write to me directly, prem@radiosai.org. That's my personal mail ID. Or you could always write to us in our regular feedback mail or a WhatsApp number, listener@radiosai.org. I'll be happy to. It'll reach me and I'll be happy to respond to that. As I said, the explanations are not perfect because it's not coming from somebody who probably doesn't, who's still sharing paroksha jnana. If it was somebody who is even sharing a paroksha jnana, I'm sure it's not going to be easy to understand because we heard some of these concepts directly from Swami and it did not make complete sense. So it does involve personal growth, right? We must grow, as Swami said in another place. All these understandings come not merely by trying to understand them. There is a change in the way we really are, which involves everything, the karma that we do, the offering that we do, the bhakti, the sadhanas, all of that together prepares this mind to begin to understand these concepts and to break down this delusion which is there in the mind. So with that, dear listeners, I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet, and I express my gratitude to each one of you for joining me week after week. Do join me next week too, 7:30 p.m. for the continuation of this Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. A short while from now, you'll be joined by Bishu for the last segment of today. Till I meet you all next week, take care. Jai Sai Ram.